From downtown Milwaukee, welcome to Money Talk with Bob Landis. Each week, professional advisors from Landis & Company Investments discuss the latest financial developments, offering timely insight and long-term perspective.
This is Money Talk for Valentine's Weekend 2021. Think it's too cold to go for a run? Well, I've got a deal for you. You can join the Steve Cullen Virtual Healthy Heart Run and Walk. Just go to cullenrun.com for all the details. Let's start with a few leftover Super Bowl tidbits. Fans bought and ate 20 million pounds of cheese for Super Bowl. So in a way, Wisconsin farmers won. And one more nugget, 6% of the fans watched the Super Bowl buck naked, hopefully not while eating hot melted cheese. If you were with us last week, you remember the San Antonio Zoo for their Valentine's Day promotion with cockroaches and rats. Well, the Lexington, Kentucky Humane Society has their own version of romance. For $10, you can buy a litter box with your ex's name on it. Why do I see more women than men buying this? A New Zealand woman was arrested for trying to smuggle 1,000 cacti into the country by strapping them to her body. Apparently, she stood up for the whole trip. Well, we've come to the Florida portion of the program. A man got arrested for driving drunk in Florida while wearing scuba gear. This is a whole new level of dumb, even for Florida. In Australia, in hopes of ridding the country of invasive carp, the health department is injecting the fish with the herpes virus. Supposedly, the virus will kill off the carp and at the same time not kill off the Friday fish fries. A man in Provence, France, built a $70 million chateau overlooking the Mediterranean, and he did it without permits. Don't get ahead of me here. But after a 10-year legal battle, the courts have given him 18 months to tear it down. I suppose he could always sell it for parts. So what have we learned today? Don't strap cactus to your body. Don't eat carp in Australia. Don't build a $70 million chateau without a permit. And most importantly, don't watch sports naked. On the podcast today, fully clothed, we have Brian Kill, Mike Helzel, Joel Dreesing, and wrapping up the week, here's Kyle Tedding.
Well, thanks a lot, Max. A lot of good life lessons in that open today, for sure. A good week overall for the markets. NASDAQ up 1.7 this week, 239 points to close the bell at 14,095. The S&P 500 up 1.2% this week, up 48 points to close at 39,35. And the Dow Jones Industrial Average up 1% this week, or 311 points, after rallying back to positive territory late in the day today to close at 31,459. For the year, Dow Jones Industrial Average now up 3%, the S&P 500 now up 4.9%, and the NASDAQ up a stellar 9.4%. Looking maybe a bit more broadly than just the headline indexes, the yield on the 10-year Treasury continues to move a bit higher, and I think we can maybe touch on that a little bit later as we talk about maybe what Treasury yields mean for our expectations for the future. And then beyond that, starting to see some pretty significant spikes in the past couple of weeks in the price of oil. And so, as you look at one of the things that was incredibly hard hit as we locked down, the oil market also is pointing to signs that things might get a little bit better here as we look ahead. So for the year, a barrel of West Texas crude now at $59.61. That's up almost 23% from where we started the year. So a pretty significant jump in oil prices. I think it's as good a time as any to jump into our weekly recap of what's going on with these GameStop trades. Worth always pointing out when we talk about this, I think this may be the last one for a while because it appears it's starting to wind down. But what is happening with GameStop, what is happening with some of these other stocks that have been mentioned in the same vein is absolutely a trading or a trade-driven thing. It's not an investment. It's not what we typically would talk about. Now, I think why it matters, though, for so many investors is because they're looking at the headlines, they're seeing how quickly things moved in such a short period of time, and they wonder what that means long-term for how we invest, for what happens to some of the people that made a lot of money, that lost a lot of money in this. And we've started to hear some stories, as federal regulators now launching a probe into GameStop, into traders around GameStop, talking about, how they might better keep an eye on these kinds of things in the future. And then, Brian, beyond that, we're starting to hear some pretty significant stories of pain, some pretty significant stories of people that have been hurt by some of the gamification of trading, even going back to before GameStop.
Well, there's a couple there. I mean, we could do a whole show on that, right, Kyle? We could do a whole week's worth of shows on that. But I think a couple of things that stand out to me about the whole GameStop thing. First of all, I think what we do as investors is we look for value and look for opportunities to buy things maybe a little cheaper than they should be. We look to buy things that might have higher quality along the way. We buy things that somehow have a rational attachment to value. What's going on in a lot of the GameStop stuff and other parts of the market is they're trading to exploit strengths and weaknesses and in momentum and they're trying to manipulate the market. They're trying to do all kinds of other things. So I think there's a huge difference between trying to invest in something over the long run that has value and trying to make money off the market in short run, irrational sometimes behaviors, you know? And I think it gets tricky because, you know, you want to give people the opportunity to do things to keep markets free. And yet when they do things that harm others unknowingly, then somebody's got to step in and kind of make sure that things are fair. Now I get a little bit concerned. There's some really tragic stories in this whole thing. But you know, if you're gonna enter into a situation where you're doing complex option tradings and you get hurt, you know, I'm not sure who there is to get blamed on that. And maybe the blame should be shared amongst many, many people. I also think if you look at both sides of that trade and you look at the hedge fund guys on one side and in the thousands of other kind of internet warriors at home trading, and you kind of try and figure out who's to blame. When Robinhood pulled out of the middle of it and changed the dynamic of that trade, nobody saw that coming. And I think that's a big warning in terms of you think you're doing things a certain way. Well, the game changes sometimes and the ground rules change sometimes. And when Robinhood pulled out, I think that changed the nature of things for both sides too. So I think there's a lot to be cautious about if you're going into the markets to make money on trading purposes. And I think if you're trying to build wealth over a long time, you need to understand the store value of what it is you're buying, and you need to invest according to those values and according to the projected potential long-term earnings, not the short-term potential swings in the market, which may be somewhat motivated by things that have nothing to do with value in the long run.
Brian, I think worth pointing out that stock prices, like just about everything else, aren't immune to the laws of gravity, that absent some kind of support for higher stock prices, and that's earnings first and foremost for stocks and interest rates as a close second, absent great earnings, absent low interest rates, it was only a matter of time before we eroded $20 billion in market cap in the matter of a couple weeks in GameStop. And those are real people that lost real money. A lot of them had made a lot of money that they probably shouldn't have made in the first place. But if you were the last one into that trade, buying at the peak, you probably have lost quite a bit. And so I think it's a strong reminder that as exciting as it is to watch what happens, as exciting as it is to hear about, some of these, really high flying stocks, there is a vast difference between investing with a fundamental understanding of what you're doing and just trying to place trades that you think are going to hit these home runs.
You know, and Kyle, that's the biggest piece of this to me is you need to know what you're doing. You need to know what you're getting into. And I think we could have long philosophical conversations about if people get harmed, who's at fault, but whatever those arguments entail, I think the person that does the trading needs to be included, and a lot of people are pointing fingers right now saying it's everybody else's fault, but hey, wait a minute, at least take some culpability for diving in and entering a world of trading that's complex and difficult and often, irrational at times, and I think know what you're doing. And if you don't know what you're doing, don't do it. And if you do and you get hurt by it, you at least have to take some responsibility for that.
And Brian, what I love about that, and maybe a great segue into another pretty meaningful trend that we've seen this week, is that there's a stark contrast between knowing what you have and knowing what you're doing, and the other side of that, and what we've been talking about for months, or if not a year now, amid this pandemic, is how much things are going to change and how important it'll be to know not just what you had before, but what you have now, what it looks like going forward. And we saw that this week with, more earnings from a number of companies where when you look at their business pre-pandemic or even a few years before the pandemic, you'd be hard pressed to find ways that they would be able to make money in this environment. And a great example is a company like Disney, where historically you were either going to the movie theaters, sitting at your home watching ABC, ESPN, or you were going to the theme park, and that's how Disney got your money. And increasingly, Disney's become a far more defensible company, a far higher growth potential company, because of streaming deals, because of content, because of things that, 5 or 10 years ago, we weren't even thinking about. And all of a sudden, yeah, Disney had a plan to get that stuff implemented, but it took on a life of its own amid this pandemic, because you had people that, maybe they had a Netflix account, but they're home a lot more now. They want to watch a lot more. And, Disney's got that Hamilton musical you want to see. Disney's got all those old Mighty Ducks films you want to see, whatever it is. I think increasingly what we're seeing is the businesses we buy today, even if they're the same names, they're very different companies than what they were 5 years ago. And you can look at Microsoft, and you can look at the car manufacturers, and you can look at the media giants. But I think, Mike, maybe a great place for you to jump in is just in understanding how much this pandemic has forced the world to change. You look at, again, something like Disney, how different of a company it is today than it was 3 or 4 years ago.
Yeah. So, you look at, like you mentioned, how Disney's kind of evolved, where when you say the name Disney, you think of theme parks, you think of Mickey Mouse, but there's just so much more to them. They're, like you said, with the streaming aspect, they have ESPN and ESPN Plus that is trying to get into the football streaming rights game now. They have Star Wars, they have Marvel, they have all of these like entertainment tentacles that are just spreading out all over, that are touching all people's lives in different ways. Like, Disney has something for you, no matter if you're a fan of Mickey Mouse or not. Like, Disney, the company, has something for everyone. And you're seeing more companies trying to be the next Disney, but I don't think they're going to be able to catch up at any time soon.
Brian, I know how big of a Disney fan you are. We've had that conversation over the years for sure. Disney's a great example, I think, of one company that certainly changed their tune, but it isn't even necessarily about, changing business models. It's even about changing manufacturing processes, about these huge productivity gains that we've been harping on for years as the next leg of economic growth, that all of a sudden, businesses coming out of this pandemic are going to be far more resilient than they were going in.
Well, I think the landscape's changing a lot, right? And you talk about, people adapt, like Disney adapting and changing and being a very different company. You saw today, and I can't remember off the top of my head who it was, Kyle, but one of the big oil producers basically saying we're dropping out of fossil fuels. And you're seeing those kinds of forward-thinking decisions being made on the fly in probably a compressed time frame because of the pandemic and whatnot. But I think it's, the conversation of the day kind of is, if we expect earnings to grow slightly over the 2019 levels, which is what our current forecasts say, that kind of presumes we're going to be back in a better place toward the end of the year than we were 2 years ago. And I think that's a fascinating conversation. I think there are certainly companies like Amazon or Disney or whoever that are prospered in this very difficult year and a half. And there are companies that certainly have had, a terrible go of it. But if you kind of look at it in terms of macro demand, I know a lot of people think there's going to be some pent up demand. We're going to come out of this thing later in the year, and we're going to spike because everybody's going to want to do all the things they haven't been able to do for a year or two. But I also think there are some businesses that will be permanently disrupted. Commercial airline flight might be one of them, where, there's just maybe I'm not going to take that trip I would have taken 2 years ago, because I realized in the interim I could do a Zoom call and close the deal and save everybody a lot of time and money. And then I think one of the parts, Kyle, that we aren't talking about is the supply side. Well, even if there is demand, even if people come back and they want all this stuff and they're willing to spend for it, are we going to be able to get it? You know, certainly services can ramp up pretty quick, but even if you're a restaurant, you got to hire waiters and more cooks and whatever. It's not as easy as it looks all the time. And I think, you know, for more manufacturing, you know, labor and material intensive businesses, who's to say that the supply chain is going to be able to ramp it up in a fashion that allows us to grow back as quickly as we were. I was talking the other day with a gentleman who reminded me that ships in the LA port right now sit for at least 6 weeks, that they're backed up so far that they can't get the materials they need in the country right now. And that's before we see the demand spike later in the year, as we all get more comfortable getting back out and about in the community and stuff. So I understand the optimism. I understand where the analysts are coming from, but I don't think it's a done deal that we get there, you know, and I think that'll be the story of the year, you know?
Right. Brian, I was reading the latest purchase manager survey for the Institute for Supply Management. This was a couple of weeks ago, and manufacturers there were saying sort of what you're saying. I mean, they were saying, hey, look, COVID came, we shut down, we figured out how to arrange our manufacturing process, that it's safe, that everybody can do this, you know, in a good fashion, but it's getting the product out the door and beyond that we're starting to have some problems with.
You know, I think as we look at kind of expectations for what that environment looks like, you know, you can do the math 1,000 different ways, and we talk about expectations all the time for earnings, for interest rates. You know, I think inflation is the thing that so many people want to point to is, you know, a likely outcome of stimulus, a likely outcome of increased demand. The reality is the market's not pointing to meaningful jumps in inflation, at least expectations for meaningful jumps in inflation. But I want to stress that that doesn't mean that we're not going to see it in certain places at certain periods in time. You know, I think you rightfully point out that there's going to be some clear supply issues once demand starts to ramp up. But even beyond that, you know, you look at the price of oil right now, that makes its way into energy prices. And on a year-over-year basis, all of a sudden you've got inflation in the energy markets simply because oil was so cheap and all of a sudden it's more reasonably priced. And so some of the problem we're going to have is that the comparisons get so challenging year-over-year on inflation that inflation just starts popping up a little bit here and there, because you're talking about prices that were severely depressed in certain areas last year. But then I think it's also worth pointing out, you know, as we talk about inflation, that some of this inflation is actually a pretty good thing. Medical price inflation as a great example, right? Well, yeah, the price of medical treatments has gone up significantly. It's one of the highest rates of inflation of any category that's measured over, you know, extended periods of time, but also outcomes have changed pretty drastically over the years. And so how do you weigh you know, the value of those outcomes versus the cost of that treatment? And we're going to have a lot of those conversations over the next 6 months or a year as we talk about, you know, the typical measures of inflation, the CPI basket. They don't do a great job of, you know, measuring the specifics of every individual household. They do a really good job of saying in aggregate, here's what we're seeing. And you can break it out into core and you can break it out into total measures of inflation. And, you know, you get a pretty broad understanding of what that looks like. But I know that we're going to have that conversation with a number of our clients on this very program 6 months from now, where we're saying, yeah, inflation's popped up a little bit in these areas and it's a supply issue or it's a demand issue, whatever it is. Again, I want to stress, though, that when you look at what rates are saying, when you look at what investors are saying, they just don't see that as a big long-term problem yet.
You know, Kyle, I thought it was interesting that this week that you had a lot of public comments from Larry Sumner's, played a big role in a couple of different administrations, economic teams and whatnot. And then you had Janet Yellen coming out and kind of saying, well, you know, we have all the tools we need to keep inflation under check. So you're already kind of seeing that debate being kind of played out in the media and in the public eye. And I think that'll certainly be something we need to pay close attention to in the months ahead, you know. But I think when you think about potential surprises and potential things that you thought might not happen, you know, some pop in inflation might be one of those things that catches us by surprise a little bit.
Mike, we talked a little bit earlier about some of the, for example, an oil company that's, or a coal company that's getting out of the coal business, or fossil fuel companies that are getting out of the fossil fuel businesses. More and more, we're seeing that. I think this current administration has certainly made that a priority. And, you know, historically, there were investments that you could make that maybe avoided those types of investments, which had fossil fuel production in them. But it was a very black and white. You either had it in your portfolio or you didn't. And I think what we've seen over the years with, you know, socially responsible investing or ESG investing or any number of other names that tend to pop up for that is that there have been some pretty significant developments in trying to broaden our understanding of what that means, trying to capture, you know, I think a bigger audience. And then on top of that, you know, creating investments that are not, that are no longer based purely on excluding businesses, but starting to understand the financial implications of more responsible investing, right? What's the financial implication for a fossil fuel company of divesting fossil fuels? I know that's something you're getting asked a lot lately. What kinds of things are you telling people?
So yeah, it's funny you bring that up. I more than ever, probably the past, I don't know, 3, 4, 5 months, I've gotten a ton of questions about, you know, like you said, socially responsible ESG funds. And so I talk to clients about it. And the funny thing about it is they're starting to understand it more, because you're seeing more kind of like when you go online and you look it up, there's different scorings and screens, and like the standards are helping clients or just people in general understand what ESG or socially responsible was. Like for a long time, that was kind of in the, kind of an off to the side. It was, you know, like, oh, socially responsible. Well, they're not taking advantage of all the ways of the market, so why would I want to get involved in that? And now as people's thought processes are changing, you're seeing more people want to get information on it. Like the data improvement, like I mentioned, is going to be a big part for like 2021, people understanding it. You mentioned the new administration. They're like really trying to reinvigorate like the ESG policy, as well as kind of a climate urgency that goes along with it, right? The other aspect I think that is kind of leading people down this path is you're seeing more businesses kind of publicly say they're focusing on like the growing threats of to nature that caused by their businesses, you know, their carbon footprint, stuff like that, and how they're reducing them. And then that's kind of leading more people into looking into these funds. And when I kind of looked into it myself, did some digging on it. You looked at in 2020, when we had that massive dip in the first half, I shouldn't say dip, crash, however you want to call it, like sustainable funds that had a focus on ESG weathered the storm so much better than funds that didn't. And that led to last year, like sustainable funds attracted $51.2 billion being poured into them, which is more than 2 times the previous record from way back in 2019, which seems like 2 decades ago, of only $21 billion. So more and more people are getting invested in this, and they're paying dividends because companies are adjusting, as you said previously, to make them more kind of socially responsible and climate responsible.
You know, Kyle, I think if you go back to the beginning of when we would kind of publicly talk about ESG, it was different in that I think back in those days, you would say, well, we want to do the right thing and we want to invest with a conscience, but it might cost you some money, you know? And I think what's both interesting and I think, you know, a strong reason to be optimistic about things in the future is that I think people are starting to look at it now as though it's a better way to make money. You know, companies that treat their employees well, companies that do things that make sense for us all in the long run, not even of an economic nature, that those companies become strong and those are the companies that will prosper. And I think, Mike, when you talk about those funds and those companies holding up better in the downturn, it's because they're better companies in many cases, you know? And I think if the investor can promote better behavior you know, and get paid for it, then everybody kind of wins along the way. And I think it's a really kind of interesting side of capitalism and the evolution of capitalism if things keep going in that direction, and kind of a positive for all.
Yeah, such a great point, Brian. I think as we look at what that type of investing means going forward, it isn't simply exclusionary screens anymore. It isn't simply, buying a fund that's only solar energy or green energy or whatever it is. It's buying businesses that long-term are going to be defensible businesses because they're not exposing themselves to things that are going to get them in trouble, whether that's issues in the workplace, whether that's issues in the environment around them or with their consumers. And I think we're realizing there are long-term financial implications to that. You can look at smoking going back to the 40s, 50s, 60s. Those tobacco companies ultimately had to pay the price and continue to receive pretty significant scrutiny now because of how they navigated those issues. And I think we're going to see that with a number of businesses as we look ahead, is there are going to be financial costs to irresponsible choices. There are going to be financial costs to those businesses that investors are going to want to punish those businesses for as well. And so if you can partner with firms that not only do good things, but then benefit from that financially, you're getting the best of both worlds. And even if you don't care about the first part of that, you're still getting companies that are financially well off.
You know, and Kyle, we're so fixated on what the government's doing, you know, regulatory stuff. And will I get a tax break, or will I get penalized or whatever? Well, we have the opportunity just to go invest the way we want and promote the things that we want to have happen. We can kind of vote with our checkbooks ourselves. You know, we don't have to wait for the government to tell us what to do. So, you know, I like that direction it's going, and I hope we keep evolving that way.
Brian, just to compound your point, I thought you made a really good one. I can't tell you how many clients I've had where you hear a story in the media about a company, you know, doing terrible things to workers. What was it? In South Dakota, when they were betting on whether their employees would get COVID or not. I forgot the meat camp packing company, so forgive me on that. But I had a couple calls from people to be like, do I have them in my portfolio? Right. And it was because they were treating their workers terribly. And if they did, they wanted to move it. They didn't. But it just kind of compounds your point of like, people are seeing these stories more now, and they don't want those companies in their portfolio, which I do find fascinating, which is a pretty big shift from just a few years ago.
Yeah.
And Joel, we've got a lot of resources on our website on responsible investing. We've done some videos over the years, written some articles and stuff that talk about those topics specifically. So certainly, to the extent that people want to know more about kind of how we view the world and how we viewed it in the past, that'd be a good place to go.
We do, Kyle. We've had these conversations for years. As Mike points out, the numbers are changed because it's evolving. More and more are recognizing that this isn't a bad way to invest money. More and more companies are getting on the bandwagon and saying this isn't a bad way to conduct ourselves as companies. So, with the show notes for this podcast today at Landis.com, I'll include a couple of links to some of the videos we've done.
Perfect. Joel, economic indicators this week that stood out to you?
We didn't have a whole lot. I mean, it sort of comes in waves. Last week we had a lot. This week we had a handful. And it's more of the same. It's telling us that, we're making our way out of the slump that we had early last year because of the pandemic. Some areas are doing better than others. There was a poll by the Wall Street Journal. They regularly survey economists on how they think the economy is going to be doing, and their forecasts improved from the last time they talked to them. They think that GDP this year is going to be 4.9%, which is a pretty strong, economic growth number. But they also thought that the U.S. would recover about 4.8 million jobs this year, and we're still 9.6 million behind where we were last year. So similar to the Congressional Budget Office report that we talked about last week, there's greater optimism for the economy as a whole, but for jobs in particular, You know, it's not looking as good. The numbers we had this week showed that job openings improved a little in January. I'm sorry, in December over November, but they're still way behind where they were last February before the pandemic started. Hiring was down. Layoffs were down a little bit, but they were up in the areas that we would expect, you know, leisure and retail and hospitality. And we do a graphic, and this is in our show notes too, looking at the number of job openings compared to the number of people who are unemployed and looking for work. And for about 2 years until last February, there were more job openings than there were people looking for jobs. So that puts labor in a really good position, right? Well, you can see in this graphic that it just turned around completely since then. And we still have a really big gap between the number of people looking for jobs and the number of opportunities they have. And it's not a real good comparison because those people aren't going to be able to qualify for all those openings, but it at least gives some good numbers on supply and demand. The other number that we had this week was you talked about inflation, and it's one of those imperfect numbers, but it's the broadest look that we have at inflation, the consumer price index. And year to year, it shows that we're still way below that 2% that the Fed has set as a good sustainable inflation rate. We haven't been at 2% much since the last recession. So that's, you know, more than a decade now. We were at about 2.4% in February, and this latest month in January, we were at 1.4%. But again, showing you some of the imperfections and some of the things that are in that, some of the nuances, the index went up mostly in January, almost totally, because of gasoline. Gasoline prices went up 7.4% on this index between December and January. But if you look year to year, gas prices were down 8.6%.
We've got a shortened trading week next week with President's Day on Monday. So bond market, stock market closed, a bank holiday as well. Joel, I know you had some President's Day trivia for us. You want to?
Oh, is it really?
I would love to know the presidents that are on the currency no longer in circulation.
Okay, so you guys just shout out if you know the answer. The $500 bill, which president would be on the $500?
Was it Millard Fillmore?
No. McKinley.
Okay.
Okay. The $1,000 bill.
Hang on, let me go check.
Brian, you should. This is one that you should know, Brian. It's a president who had the same name as a Sesame Street character.
Grover Cleveland.
Yes, thank you.
Oscar the Grouch.
On the $5,000 bill, any guesses?
I am
befuddled. This is tough, Joel.
James Madison.
Okay.
And here's we had a $100,000 bill. It's not a candy bar. It's a U.S. currency note.
Ollie Madison.
No. I'd like to put that in the machine and not have
what
it.
What would
off.
You use that on?
$100,000 bill. That was Woodrow Wilson.
Yeah. Wow.
Well, that's a good one to end the week on, Joel. I appreciate our President's Day trivia here. Maybe in honor of President's Day, you can go see if you can hunt down one of those $100,000 bills next week. And if you find one, let us know. We'd be happy to help you invest it.
Well, take it to 7-Eleven and buy a Baby Ruth bar with it.
You know? There you go. Yeah. Well, thanks for listening. We enjoy talking to you, and we'll do it again next week.
Thank you for listening to Money Talk with Bob Landis. If you have a financial question you want answered on next week's show, email it to moneytalk@landis.com. To keep informed throughout the week, visit our Money Talk page at landis.com.